acutely, actually, both emotionally and in terms of who was there with him through this book. And it's magically put together.
You also said that nonfiction is, and history is, one of your loves. And we should in a moment hear an extract from one of your nonfiction choices, which is Nigel Jones's book, The Tower, which he describes as an epic history of the Tower of London. And we're going to start with a passage which describes a new arrival at the zoo established in the Tower by King Henry III back in the 13th century. John.
In 1252, the creatures at the Tower were joined by another exotic animal, a polar bear sent to Henry by King Haakon IV of Norway arrived, along with a Norwegian keeper. The first ever seen in England, the polar bear attracted enormous public curiosity. When the 2 pence a day allowance provided by the sheriffs of London for its upkeep proved insufficient to meet the beast's appetite, the bear was allowed to fish for free food in the river running past its tower enclosure. With his usual attention to detail, Henry spelt it out. "Greetings. We command you that for the keeper of our white bear, lately arrived from Norway, ye cause to be had 1 muzzle and 1 iron chain to hold the bear without the water, and 1 long strong cord to hold the same bear fishing or washing himself in the River Thames." 3 years later, in 1255, when Londoners had got used to the strange sight of the bear swiping salmon out of the Thames, an even more wondrous beast lumbered into view. Befitting its size and status, the entry of this new addition to the Tower menagerie was slow and stately, attracting enormous crowds en route, like the progress of a superstar, which it was. The first elephant to appear in these islands plodded up the pilgrim's way from Canterbury to London, led by its keeper, Henricus de Flor. Yet another gift to Henry from a fellow European monarch, Louis IX of France, the elephant made a spectacular entrance to the Tower via a large riverboat. Such was the jumbo's celebrity that the aged contemporary chronicler, the monk Matthew Paris, was lured from his abbey in St. Albans to the Tower to see the new arrival. Drawing the elephant in a memorable picture, as well as in words, "The beast is about 10 years old, possessing a rough hide rather than fur, has small eyes at the top of his head, and eats and drinks with a trunk."
Many thanks, John. I mean, that's an extraordinary thought, a polar bear fishing on the banks of the Thames. I think wasn't even thought of as part of the Cultural Olympiad. This was clearly going one stage beyond that. Did you know anything about this wonderful detail of a private zoo at the Tower of London before reading this book?
I did know something about it, but the book it goes into incredible detail about it. And I love, one of the things I like about this book is the pageant of it, that you really get this, it's a very brutal book in many ways and focuses on lots of, warring skirmishes amongst other things, and changes of monarchy.
I mean, is it that wider historical pageant and, you know, this sort of mixture of pageantry and violence that fascinates you in terms of the wider story?
I feel a big vacuum in my knowledge about history, and it's something which I'm more aware of the more I do. And, you know, my work is based in history. It's based in, you know, the context of great musical works of art over the last 400-500 years. And I'm mildly ashamed that, well, I put it stronger than that, I'm pretty ashamed that I don't have a stronger knowledge of the story around that. I went recently to Australia and I took Simon Sharma's History of Britain as an audio book. And listen to that every night with jet lag, actually. And I saw Timothy West, who's narrating it, actually came to a performance at E&O soon after I got back, and I told him that he helped put me to sleep every night, which wasn't necessarily such a big compliment for a great actor. But it's just something I'd really want to develop in myself.
When you're actually preparing an operatic production, do you find that there's a need to actually read up on the history of the story or the circumstances in which the production came together? And I'm thinking you're conducting Peter Grimes later at the Proms, and of course George Crabbe's poem The Borough, very much at the background of that, adapted of course in the 20th century for Grimes. How important is that background reading for you on that sort of production?
Yes, it's very important, actually, and Billy Budd recently as well, that we've done at E&O. I do, more and more I do, actually. And I've been fortunate recently to do a lot of music where the composers were at least around their recordings. In Britten's case, he was conducting, you know, many of the recordings. And the flavour of that time is so important to capture, and it's hard to do in the modern world, I think. I'm thinking of pieces like Rosenkavalier, which I've conducted this year. I think you need to know the flavour of what was going on, and it was immensely helpful for me to listen to Eric Kleiber's recordings from the you know, the 50s in Vienna to get a sense of that. I mean, it's a perfume, isn't it, that you can't just pluck out of the air in today's world.
Well, let's stick with the Tower of London for a couple of minutes more, because in many people's minds, it is regarded as a place of torture and of terror. And of course, as you've suggested, that is in Nigel Jones's book. But it was also something of a refuge for at least some people. And the second extract you've chosen suggests that rather strongly. John.
King Henry VI vanished for more than a year, leaving behind only a few pathetic belongings, including his crown and a spoon. He was sheltered by loyal northern gentry, shuttling between their homes and sometimes, appropriately for such a pious man, disguised as a monk seeking sanctuary at religious houses. In July 1465, the fugitive king was hiding at Waddington Hall near Clitheroe in Lancashire, the home of the Tempest family, under the care of his former carver and chamberlain, Sir Richard Tunstall. But one member of the family, John Tempest, did not share his relative's Lancastrian loyalty. Informed by a treacherous monk of the mystery guest at the hall, Tempest organized a posse. When they arrived, a furious struggle ensued. Tunstall held the pursuers off, breaking Tempest's arm in the process, while Henry, accompanied only by two chaplains and a single squire, made off into nearby Clither Wood. Later that afternoon, Henry and his companions were caught, crossing the River Ribble by stepping stones, and arrested. Humiliatingly, Henry, wearing a straw hat in the summer heat, was mounted on a poor thin nag. His feet were bound under the stirrups by leather thongs, and, lashed to his saddle with rope, he was brought to London. He was received at Islington by the Earl of Warwick, and led through the city's streets towards the Tower, a placard scrawled with insults around his neck. It was a tragic and frightening return to his capital for the mentally frail, fallen monarch. As the forlorn little procession rode through Cheapside, Cornhill, and Newgate, ribald crowds of Londoners followed their progress, yelling abuse and hurling refuse and stones at the helpless captive. The saintly Henry heard his wife called a whore, and worse, before the Tower's gates mercifully closed behind him, muffling the hostile jeers. It was to be his home for the last decade of his sad life.
I mean, Edward, when I read that passage and also heard John reading it so beautifully there, I thought, on the one hand, you know, clearly what an awful moment for the king, but also what an operatic moment.
Maybe that's why I liked it so much. I mean, certainly, the story of Henry VI itself is fascinating because he was such a spiritual, artistic, and gentle man. I mean, strange, I'm sure. But that idea of him, you know, in public view, so close, in such close proximity to the braying public being taken back into London is extraordinary, and we can't identify with that at all nowadays. It's really an amazing image of both the jeopardy of the time, and also an incredibly sort of close relationship between the public and the monarch.
Is it that sense of the kind of the turbulence, the flavour of politics lived almost on the streets during much of the time that this book covers that appeals, do you think? I mean, in some sense, it is rather different from a more democratic and, for the most part, perhaps, thankfully, more tranquil era that most of us have lived through.
Not sure. I'm not sure how to answer that. It's just... I mean, I love living in London. I wasn't born here, but I really feel it's my city. And I love living in a historical part of London. And anything that I'm not, I mean, I live, I guess, about a mile away from the Tower of London itself. And anything that just makes my vision of the city or my vision of the history of the city more keen, I really love. I find it very, you know, I find it fascinating.
And obviously we're right in the middle of the Olympics at the moment, and, you know, London is, you know, the focus of the world, at least for a couple of weeks. Do you feel that along with this very strong sense of community which has been created, not least due to great sporting success, we could do with more of a sense of that historical trajectory that underpins the story that we've come to now?
It's hard, that, isn't it? And Olympics is about celebrating the present time and the future, one, you know, you hope. I mean, the opening ceremony, I suppose, had a flavour of some of the history of the country, but I'm not sure it's possible to do that. But hopefully, what you hope is that everything that's created by such an extraordinary sporting unifying event like the Olympics can be carried forward. I think it's much more forward-looking.
And I think that brings us to your final reading, because this is, you know, as you described, I think, earlier, a busman's holiday. It's a book on a subject that couldn't really be closer to home, and that is, of course, conducting. And this is the book Music as Alchemy by Tom Service. Now, it's a series of biographical sketches. It takes basically six conductors and their orchestras and says something about how they work on a particular concert at a particular time. And in a moment, we're going to hear a passage about Tom Service's experience of hearing one conductor, Ivan Fischer, conducting Mahler. But before we start, could you tell me why this particular passage jumped out at you when you were reading this book?
The passage, the chapter about Ivan Fischer and the Budapest Festival Orchestra, it starts off with this wonderful description of how they start rehearsals. And the conductor, and it's so utopian, and it could never, there are so few places in the world where it could exist. The orchestra tune up together under the direction of the conductor, and then they'll play Bach chorales together before they even, you know, get to the main meat of their programs, just to, you know, experiment and get a sense of sound and you know, the sense of ranges of sound and tuning. And it's kind of, yeah, it's wonderful and completely unique, I'd say.
From the opening bar, the music is energized by a collective will from the orchestra to make all the characters, colors, and contrasts that Fischer had developed in the week of rehearsals as vivid as possible. From the vice-like grip of the implacable repeated notes at the start of the first movement, the symphony creates an energy that is impossible to resist. It's a performance of gigantic structural momentum, a vindication of Mahler's self-conscious classical pretensions in this piece. More than any other of his symphonies, this piece takes the forms of the conventional 19th century symphony and stretches them to breaking point. But it's also a thrilling existential drama in which symphonic form is transmuted into psychological experience. The immediacy of the relationship between Fischer and his players releases something I have never heard in this music before. For those 90 minutes in the concert hall, there is no distance between us, the composer, the performers, and the piece. The Sixth Symphony is a journey we go on together, which Fischer and the players unflinchingly take to ecstatic, tragic extremes. By the end of the finale, the performance had created a trance that I find difficult to escape. The terrifying reality of the music makes the world of applause, of people, of social interaction after the concert seem a hollow illusion. It takes hours before the trance or the truth of Mahler's music recedes.
Thank you, John. Edward, Tom Service was clearly pretty much overwhelmed by the experience of hearing Fischer and the Budapest Band playing this Mahler Sixth. When you're on the podium, are you able to actually ever give yourself over to being absorbed by the performance in that way? Or when you're the man at the front of the orchestra, is there always a part of you that simply can't allow yourself to dive in quite that way?
I think you you can be completely absorbed by a performance you're in, but it'll always be in a different way from an audience. And I mean, the performances where I felt most integrated with somehow are the ones where you don't feel like you're working to create anything. It's just sort of happening with you and around you. Opera's very interesting like that because there are so many different facets, the singers, the children's choir, the offstage musicians, the pit, that you almost don't know when the great performances of a run are going to be. And I love it for that. I love that a performance is created and vanishes in the ether. But I don't think you ever have the same experience as someone in the audience. Another conductor said something very funny to me when this other conductor thinks he's done the most world-beating performances, he's told by people in the audience it's one of the worst, performances of something you've ever given. And then, conversely, when you feel like you've had a terrible evening in the pit or on the concert hall because you felt slightly out of control, people tell you it had risen to great glories because of it. But so it's hard to say. Your experience is so different from that of an audience.
But when you are in the audience listening to someone else conducting something, do you find something of that kind of total absorption that Tom Service was talking about in the way
that you listen? Oh, sure, in great performances, for sure, yeah. Yeah, you're united with an audience in that, yeah. I think an audience in a collective way feels that, actually, which is, it's a really wonderful thing to be in an auditorium as part of that mass of people experiencing something on that level.
In Music as Alchemy, Tom Service, he analyzes these conductors in a very rigorous way, but broadly speaking, he seems to divide them into two categories: conductors who really go minute by minute, page by page, over the score with the orchestra over and over again, and the guys, I'm not going to call them chancers, but people who live a little bit more on the edge, people who are really sort of saying, let's busk it and then see what happens on the day. Do you see yourself in either of those categories?
Well, I suppose that's how people divide conductors generally, isn't it? I mean, it's way too broad to say you're in one or other the category. I love the fact that he doesn't actually try and unify what these people are in the book, actually. I think he really presents a series of personalities working with a series of orchestral personalities, which I find is much more truthful. I wouldn't like to... It's up to other people to categorise me, I think, probably.
That's fair enough. But within the book, there are particular conductors, and they're pretty much big-name conductors, whose technique he analyses. I mean, even Fischer is the extract that you chose there. Is Fischer someone that you know, that you've worked with?
I've trained a chorus for him in Salzburg many years ago, but he's someone I've admired, and I've admired that, as Tom would say, that alchemy or that, that connection between a great orchestra and a great conductor is something which really fascinates me. And that connection between any orchestra and any conductor is really fascinating. And he has something very special with that orchestra.
If you had one fantasy conductor, as it were, that you could spend time with and look into his technique, who would that be?
I think most conductors give you the same answer, which is Carlos Kleiber. I was fortunate enough that one of my great friends didn't send me a clip of him conducting Rosenkavalier on a pit camera until after I'd finished conducting Rosenkavalier, because it's effortless and brilliant and varied. And I think you'd want another career after watching too much of his stuff, because it's peerless and so expressive, but the intention of it is so clear.
Well, with those thoughts, we are, I'm afraid, drawing to a close for this event, but it's been a great pleasure to have you here. So many thanks to Edward Gardner, and many thanks also to our reader, John Rowe. Thank you both very much indeed.
Rana Mitter presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Zahid Worley. Well, this is Penny Gore welcoming you back to the Royal Albert Hall and this BBC Prom, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Semyon Bychkov. We're live on BBC Radio 3 and online, where you can listen in high-definition sound. And you can follow us on Twitter too, at BBC Proms is the place to be. Now, it was announced just yesterday that Semyon Bychkov has had a new post with the BBC Symphony Orchestra created for him, the Günter Wandt Conducting Chair, a mark of the warm relationship he's forged with the players. And next, he conducts them in a real orchestral titan by a composer with whom he has a great affinity. It's Richard Strauss's tone poem Ein Heldenleben, commonly translated as A Hero's Life. Although tonight's conductor, Semyon Bychkov, makes a subtle distinction.
Ein Heldenleben, to be translated correctly, would not mean hero's life. It would mean heroic life. And that is quite interesting because it stops being about an individual, whether it is Strauss or it is anyone else, a specific hero. Once you think that it is about heroic life, well, every life is heroic, every life that is worthwhile is going to be heroic because there are sacrifices that are going to be made, losses that will be incurred, certain goals that will need to be attained, and they can only be done through utmost dedication. So the piece become a lot more meaningful and not a description of war or love. It is actually a life cycle. And that a man, as young as he was when he composed it in his early 30s, was capable of expressing something so true to life that he was also able to anticipate in the final coda what he and every one of us will feel throughout different stages of one's life, including the final stage. That is really as great a genius as one can be.
Semyon Bychkov. Well, at almost 50 minutes long, this work is as heroic in scale as it is in subject matter and written for large orchestral forces. Strauss wrote the piece in the late 1890s when he was at the peak of his early professional career. He'd become a well-known conductor, especially distinguished for his interpretations of Wagner, while his own composing career was progressing nicely too, thanks to a string of impressive tone poems. Within a few years, he'd embark on his long run of highly successful operas. But all this apparent good fortune wasn't quite as seamless as it might sound. Strauss's first opera, the Wagner-inspired Guntram, hadn't been a great hit. In fact, the critics had given it a real pasting. And Strauss had a long memory when it came to professional slights. The whole painful experience of the opera was just one of the ingredients that he blended to produce Ein Heldenleben. Although he did keep his sense of humour, the protagonist, let's say with at least elements of Strauss himself, is just too noble and upstanding to be true, bravely battling with those critics whose mean-spirited carping emerges as a gruff chorus of woodwind, two tubas and trombones. But our hero wins the day in his battle with the bad guys. Cue a mischievous quote from the horn theme from Don Juan. Finally, he withdraws from the hustle and bustle of the world with his faithful companion by his side. And that's a thinly disguised portrait of Strauss's own wife, the soprano Paulina de Anna, who was famed for her volatile personality. Strauss once described her as very complex, very feminine, a little perverse, at every minute different from how she had been the moment before. And all her lightning changes of mood are captured by a coquettish solo violin. And the BBC Symphony Orchestra just settled down, awaiting the arrival of Semyon Bychkov, who makes his way on stage now to conduct this BBC Proms performance of Ein Heldenleben by Richard Strauss.
Thank you.
Well, is it a hero's life, or as Semyon Bychkov prefers, a heroic life? Maybe something of both in Richard Strauss's great tone poem, I'm Helden Leben, performed here at the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under Semyon Bychkov, newly appointed holder of the orchestra's Günter Wandt conducting chair. And that great cheer you just heard was for the guest leader, Sergei Levitin, in beautifully capricious mood. And a few special mentions for other players. Amin Merchant, the principal second violin, has just given his last concert with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. He's off to lead the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra. And going around the sections, Caroline Harrison, the principal viola, principal cello, Susan Monks, and the woodwind who made such a wonderful contribution, principal flute, Michael Cox, principal oboe, Richard Simpson, principal cor anglais, Alison Teal, and principal clarinet, Richard Hosford, really bringing out the beauty of that piece. And Semyon Bychkov has spoken often about how important Strauss's music is to him, and you could really tell that from his rehearsal and the performance. He feels it so deeply and delves into the music. He's eager to find every little nuance and really stressing the beauty of Strauss's long sweeping lines. A few more players to pick out: the principal bassoon, Julie Price, and principal horn, Martin Owen. The guest principal trumpet and first E-flat trumpet was Martin Griebel, and the first B-flat trumpet, Gareth Bimson. Semyon Bychkov making his way back on stage now. Great cheers from audience and orchestra. And Sergei Levitin shaking the conductor's hand and taking his own solo bow. Well, there's not much rest on the cards for the players. They're back in action on Sunday in Schoenberg's mighty cantata Gurrelieder with conductor Jukka-Pekka Saraste. I'll be back here too then, but with this applause and these cheers still ringing round the Royal Albert Hall, I'll return you for now to James Jolly for the rest of the evening on BBC Radio 3.
Thanks very much, Penny. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Monday the 20th of August at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. We return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow night at 6:30 for a concert given by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Jon Sturgårds, in music by Sibelius, Delius and Grieg. And now, a few minutes later than scheduled, Adam Nicholson concludes his exploration of the ideas of Arcadia in Western culture, asking why every version of idyllic life seems to contain its opposite, death and darkness. Yesterday's feature took him to Virgil and Horace's Italy. This evening, we begin closer at home, in Renaissance Wiltshire, dark Arcadias.
The Arcadian ideas inherited from classical Rome came in a double stream, one from Virgil, who is really interested in making a world that is perfect as a whole, and the other from Horace, who is looking for a perfect spot in a troubled world. But both those streams had really rather faded in the Middle Ages, and only in the 16th century did they start to enjoy a new Renaissance. And that's what I'm going to explore in this programme. The way in which they flowered in Elizabethan and Jacobean England, in the great landscape parks and gardens of the 18th century, and then on into the more difficult conditions of Victorian and modern Britain, where all that gentlemanly smoothness of Arcadia came to seem inadequate or wrong in various ways. And then how this long story delivers us to a double conclusion, the Virgilian desire to conserve the world as a whole in its best possible state, and the very Horatian search, which we're all engaged in, for a micro-Arcadia, for little spots of beauty, where the Arcadian idea has become more private than it's ever been. But we begin here on the banks of the River Nadder in Wiltshire, at one of the great Arcadian palaces of 17th century England, Wilton House, the home of the Pembrokes. The extraordinary thing about this painting is that the girl in the middle of it, the young woman, she's only 12, and she's about to get married to that beautiful young man. And she is bringing with her into this glorious gilded world a dowry which is worth 2,000 years of a Wiltshire shepherd's salary. £25,000, and a Wiltshire shepherd would have earned £12.10 in the year. And I think in some ways that is the heart of this Arcadia, that it is about massive privilege, enormous wealth, absolutely dominating power here in London, nationally, even internationally, this huge sort of quasi-royal family, indulging an idea that their place here in this gilded, enriched, massively demonstrative, sort of fat, fruity room is in fact a kind of act of nature. And there's a very odd, unmodern elision of things in that, that we think somehow nature is easy, accessible to all, a kind of general, almost contentless place. But the Renaissance idea, inherited, of course, from all those Roman ideas, is that it too has a hierarchy. Hierarchy is beautiful in it, and that the people at the top of the hierarchy, these satin-gilded beasts, are the most beautiful. This was the house and headquarters of the whole enterprise of the Earls of Pembroke, who were almost certainly the richest family in early 17th century England. They owned tens of thousands of acres of Wiltshire, huge acreages of central London, intimately involved with the court, with James I, Charles I, and great patrons, patrons of Shakespeare, of Herbert, of Johnson, of Donne, enormously and centrally involved in the whole cultural enterprise of England. And this room, designed by Inigo Jones in the 1630s, is a double cube in that kind of very sort of exact neoclassical way, but enormously embellished with carved fruits, carved vegetables, carved caryatids, a vast painted cove, almost certainly painted by the people who painted the scenery for the masks that were put on in Whitehall. And so you've got a complete capsule of 17th century loveliness here. And right at the end, dominating the room, as it's meant to, is the largest painting that Van Dyck ever painted, 17 feet wide, 10 feet high, filled with the family who owned this place. They're painted slightly larger than life size, so that they loom over the room, almost like a royal family at the end of it, on a slightly raised dais, but with an intriguing mix of inside and outside in the way the picture is set. You can't quite tell where it is. It isn't exactly in a palace. It isn't exactly on the steps of a palace. It might even be on a stage. To the right, there is a giant coat of arms implying their inherited grandeur. To the left, an Italianate, receding, sunlit landscape, the Arcadian world, which extends from that edge of the picture through the windows and into the valley of the Nadder outside. The man who sits in the centre of this painting is Philip, the fourth Earl of Pembroke, who was a courtier to James I and then Charles I. But it was his grandfather, William Herbert, an absolute brute of a man, a bruising condottieri, really, of mid-Tudor England, who first came to Wilton in the 1540s, was given it by Henry VIII because his sister-in-law married the king, which is sort of winning the lottery in Tudor England. And then around the house, as one did, he laid out a park. And a park is, of course, the vehicle for any number of Arcadian ideas. It is the place where ease and happiness and elegance and beauty can all fuse and intersect. It is the landscape of Arcadian dominance. And to make his park, he kicked out some of the villagers who'd been living just on the far side of the river over there. And in the late 1540s, they, impoverished by the denial of their ancestral lands, decided to reclaim part of the park, and they reinvaded it, as in fact many parks were reinvaded in England in the late 1540s. And Herbert, instead of accommodating or negotiating with the invaders, went to Wales, where he had other vast estates, gathered an army of his tenants from there, marched them back to Wilton, invaded his own park, hunted and killed his own tenants in the park, leaving it then a satisfactorily pure and natural space in which his soul could expand. And that place in which he had killed his own tenants, was the place in which his son's wife's brother, that is Philip Sidney, would later come and write the Arcadia, which he dedicated to his sister, the Countess of Pembroke. And so you have as tight a fusion as you like between violence and Arcadianism. Arcadianism is inconceivable without the damage done to those ordinary people 20 or 30 years before. It has its own guilt built into it. The idea of Sidney writing about the beauty of the Arcadian life in this dominated, controlled, and crucially excluding space is deeply ironic, because the vision that Sidney was trying to recapture of the shepherd at ease with his flocks was actually available to him outside the park boundary. There they really were, Wiltshire shepherds in their long white woolen hooded cloths, looking exactly like you'd imagine them in some painting by Lorraine or Poussin, but of course living in conditions of grindingly desperate poverty. The price of a shepherd's crook, as paid for a young countess to appear in a Whitehall mask, would have been pretty well what a shepherd was paid in the course of an entire year's work on the Wiltshire Downs. When Sidney was here visiting his sister in the 1580s, he was noticed riding across these hills by the local farmers, and one of them was the grandfather of the great 17th century gossip, John Aubrey, on whose farm I am now, just near Broadchalk. And Aubrey's grandfather remembered Sidney, as he told Aubrey, hunting in our pleasant plains, and taking his table book, that's a reusable notebook, out of his pocket and writing down his notions as they came into his head. "My sheep are thoughts," Sidney wrote in that notebook, as if poetry and reality fused here. And you could say that is a definition of Arcadia. It's a place where there is no distinction between the real world and the dream world. There were hills which garnished their proud heights with stately trees, humble valleys whose base estate seemed comforted with the refreshing of silver rivers, meadows enamelled with all sorts of eye-pleasing flowers, thickets which, being lined with most pleasant shade, were witnessed so too by the cheerful disposition of many well-tuned birds, each pasture stored with sheep, feeding with sober security, while the pretty lambs with bleating oratory craved the dam's comfort. Here a shepherd's boy piping, as though he should never be old. There a young shepherdess knitting and withal singing, and it seemed that her voice comforted her hands to work, and her hands kept time to her voice's music. As for the houses of the country, for many houses came under their eye, they were all scattered, no two being one by the other, and yet not so far off as that it barred mutual succour, a show, as it were, of an accompanable solitariness and of a civil wildness. Now that's Sidney's description of the downs that I'm sitting on now and which he rode over when staying with his sister at Wilton. A description really of a completely at-ease world, a world in which nothing is too busy, nothing too desolate, nothing too close, nothing too crammed, nothing too isolated, where every ingredient seems to enjoy the presence of the other. In other words, it is a well-arranged world, a civil wildness. It's not about, you know, romantic horror or shock or excitement. It's about comfort and being at ease. And of course, the unstated thing is that the person who feels most at ease is Sidney himself. It's a strangely unknown bit of England, this, which is odd to say that because it's right in the middle of the busy south of England. But here, sitting in one of these dry, grassy valleys, bottoms as they're called, in Wiltshire, with vetches and knapweed and hawkbit scattered all over the sides of them, like a kind of William Morris wallpaper. Cattle just grazing, some sheep over on the other side there. I mean, this looks extraordinarily like it must have looked to Sidney, almost unchanging. And there's something Arcadian in that too, that when these grandees come here and acquire this because they're in with Henry VIII and are making the right deals with the power structures, they find themselves possessors of a world which looks like, and perhaps in some ways has never changed. It looks as if this is the eternal state of affairs, one in which they have a natural place. And I think there is a deep comfort in that, that for all the stress and struggle and doing down of one's rivals that are necessary to get here, when you get here, it looks as if none of that has ever happened. Well, here we're just, I'm just on the banks of the Ebble, the little chalk stream, which is on John Aubrey's farm, just a few miles west of Wilton. And it's right in the middle of this really lush and juicy bit of river valley. And the whole structure of this part of the world is that you have these beautiful streams with lovely clear water that you can see the grayling and the trout in, all hiding in the shadows in the corners of the waterweed. And then above them, the chalk downs on both sides. And so the world is sort of strung between the wet and the dry, between the rich and the habitable, and the high and the sort of slightly austere. And this is the kind of necessary part of the balanced world. And one of the great things about the vision of Arcadia that Sidney found here, and which Aubrey and his whole family loved him for, was that it wasn't just a sort of little window, it wasn't a little display park of the Arcadian. It was genuinely a whole world. And it's a whole world not only physically like that, but socially too, so that the way in which people lived with each other here was deeply bound together. I've just caught the weed on the far side there. No, but the way in which they lived here was very carefully and consciously designed to be a sort of balanced world. And so the relationship between landlord and tenant, between the people living in the villages and the people living in places like Wilton, wasn't just a cash relationship,
There were mutual obligations on each side, and people in the 16th century wrote theories of land ownership in which there were chapters called love, which you wouldn't find many estate agents, courses having that nowadays. But love was meant to be the essence of how these places worked. And it's not only love between people, but it's love between different animal and vegetable and geographical parts of the valleys that they lived in. It's not at all surprising that this is where Arcadia came to seem like a possibility, that it's away from harassment. It's like a life spent fishing. One of the beautiful things about Wilton and Sidney's vision of Arcadia there is that it wasn't just a private little garden dream of the perfect world. It was genuinely and really social. It was absolutely involved with the well-being of people who were living there in farms and villages, of arrangements between the grandees and the poor, which weren't exploitative, which did give dignity to the peasants as they really were. I mean, of course there was fierce differences in wealth and the things that they could control, the physical things they could command. Of course there was. But against that background of hierarchy, there was an idea that the Arcadian needed to consider the well-being of those who didn't have access to material things. And something of that falls away in the course of the 17th century. And so by the time you come to the great British Augustan age at the beginning of the 18th century, the vision of Arcadia has become much more aestheticized, has dropped much of its social dimension, and has become really a desire to make a beautiful picture, a beautiful image, something which can gratify you, the owner of it, without much concern for what's going on outside its boundaries. So if the Wilton and Sidney view had in a way been Virgilian, then what takes over from that in the 18th century is a Horatian love of the perfect place, and in effect let the world go hang, recognise its pains. But it's not what I'm going to be interested in, sitting back and drinking my glass of Pinot Grigio. This is Rousham in Oxfordshire, William Kent's pocket handkerchief masterpiece of a very, very early landscape garden. And it is like a little fragment of the dream of Italy transferred to the English Midlands. Little valleys, little woods, little dropping lawns, stone goddesses and gladiators glimpsed around the corner of yew trees and laurel bushes. A kind of shrinking of the Sabine Hills to something that can't be more than 5 or 6 acres, but so sleekly designed that somehow you feel that there is largeness around you. You're only ever in small corners of it with the hint of a Roman arch or the columns of a little temple, often very, very miniaturized. But you get the sense that the world might continue beyond these boundaries in as perfect a condition as it is in here. And right in the middle of it is the thing which makes it one of my favourite places in the whole world, called the Rill. A little spring, a tiny little spring, comes out of the hillside just below one of these temples and then runs down in the middle of a slightly valleyed gravel path between glossy laurel bushes on either side and with dark shade of yews hanging over it. And it runs down in this very narrow stone trench, no more than a foot wide, and the water in it about an inch deep. just curling slightly as it comes down this shallow hillside, just a kind of very, very easy turning. Not regular, nothing stiff, nothing sort of polite about it, just water totally at ease in the world into which it's emerged. And it is like a kind of metaphor of perfection. Its silence is so incredible that this water running here at my foot, you can hear it if I put my fingers in it. But even if I put my ear within half an inch of it, there is no noise at all. And I'm sure that's part of it, that there's nothing broken, you know, nothing interrupting its feeling that the world is all right. It is a very, very well-dressed bit of wildness. It's bien soigné nature, and entrancing for that. But I can't help but have another thought.